On paper, Korea and Japan should be best of allies. They face common regional threats and share a common ally, mainly the United States. As major trading nations, they also have common global interests when it comes to shipping and market stability. They are also both democracies attempting to address shared societal concerns such as gender inequality, social isolation, and pollution. The similarities go on and on. But this month, the world was reminded once again that the relationship between the Republic of Korea and Japan is deeply fractious. Japan has imposed restrictions on the export of chemical components for semiconductor chips, accusing South Korea of failing to provide sufficient guarantees that these materials are not being smuggled into North Korea. However, the accusation also comes amid rift between the two countries over the South Korean court's ruling that select Japanese companies that forced Koreans into slave labor during the Second World War had to compensate surviving victims. The crisis builds on top of existing tensions around other historical legacy issues stemming from Japan's 35-year colonial occupation of Korea, including a disputed islet, ongoing controversy around compensation for sexual slavery by the Japanese military, and how Japan writes about these historical events in its textbooks. The U.S. government has encouraged the two countries to make amends for decades, but with no avail. In this environment, who can be the advocate of reconciliation? Our guests today believe that the private sector has a critical role to play. This episode is in two parts. The first was recorded before the export restrictions were announced. The second part was recorded after Japan's imposition of restrictions, and one of the guests returned to provide her take on the situation. It's a deeply timely episode. With no further delay, from the Korea Economic Institute in Washington, D.C., I'm your host, Yong Kwon, and this is Korean Context. Kristen Vicasey is an assistant professor in the Department of Political Science at the University of Maine. Jiwon Nam is a graduate of the Master of Arts in Global Policy program at the University of Maine School of Policy and International Affairs and will be starting a PhD program at the University of Delaware. They are the authors of the recent KEI academic paper titled Finding an Advocate, the Role of the Private Sector in Korea-Japan Relations. You can find a copy on KEI's website and in the description of this episode below. Thank you both for joining Korean Context today.
Thanks for having us. Pleasure to be here.
Thanks for having us.
Your research has an interesting approach to the friction between these two countries, Korea and Japan, specifically the role that businesses play. Professor Vicasey, what brought you to the topic of private sector's role in ROK-Japan ties?
I've been working on a project for a long time that looks at the role of the Japanese private sector in China. And I was really interested in trying to do a comparative study that looked at when there's political friction, political tensions in Korea or China, how there's different forms of economic backlash or uses of economic coercion against Japanese firms. So at that time, when I was trying to do this comparative study, I was able to pair up with Jiwon, who was a student at that time, and we started to try and look into it. After we have these, you know, flare-ups about territorial issues or historical issues, what sorts of consequences for the Japanese private sector would we see? To our deep surprise, we weren't really able to find any. We found really, really limited instances of boycott activity or of trade flows being interrupted, of Japanese firms losing contracts, like all of these things that I had found lots of evidence for in the Chinese case, I really couldn't find in Korea. And so instead of doing a comparative study of how there's different forms of coercion, we tried to explain why don't we see economic coercion in the Korean case when we find so many cases of it in the Chinese case. We have a forthcoming paper in the Journal of Asian Studies and International Affairs that explores that. And this paper that we were able to happily write for KEI tries to look at the implications of that. If there are not these really high risks of economic coercion in Korea, then what? And one of the things that we think is really important is a potential role for the private sector in trying to improve Korea-Japan ties.
And Jiwon, was there any particular catalyzing moment that led you to get involved in this project?
Yes. So for this particular paper, we were looking at 2018, starting with the court ruling about Korean forced labor issues, and after that, the radar issue in the disputed waters. So all these political issues, we wanted to look into if trade has to do anything with deteriorating Korea and Japan relationship.
My attention was brought to this one line that you mentioned in the paper about how the conflict between Korea and Japan is to some degree by the choice of the political leadership, particularly the conflict between the two countries around historical issues. And yet, from an outside observer's perspective, I feel like some people might assume that this is more of a grassroots conflict. The issue over the islet in the Sea of Japan EC is often brought up by civic organizations in Japan. And on the issues of historical legacies of Japanese colonialism in Korea, it's also oftentimes grassroots organizations fighting oftentimes against the Korean government that wants to move forward with perhaps a free trade agreement, joint security agreements that we saw during the Lee Myung-bak and Bakken-hae administration. So, Professor Vicasey, would you be able to perhaps elaborate further on what you meant by the political leadership really having a choice behind the conflict between the two countries?
So there's a lot of scholarship out there that looks at some of these issues. And in the Korean context, there's a great paper that came out in the Journal of Asian Studies recently in the last couple of years that looks at whether and how Korean politicians use anti-Japanese sentiment in electoral activities. And they find across parties and across time that playing the Japan card, as you might say, or bringing up these very historically resonant issues is a winner. Mm-hmm. Right. So Japan always loses in Korean elections, and Korean politicians win if they respond to these civil society voices, so which certainly exist. But it is an issue also of political leadership, because the politicians could choose to respond to these civic organizations in different ways. And in both the Japanese and the Korean context, that's not what we typically see happening. So if we look at Japanese politics, we could go back now 15 years to Koizumi, Prime Minister Koizumi, and he chose which constituents to really focus on. And one of those constituencies that he really chose to focus on was this organization of veterans. And that led to a lot of very nationalistic statements that led to great anger in Korea, in China. Prime Minister Abe also has made a political choice to cater to those groups. And those are strategic political choices that the politicians are making. And different choices could be made. Another really important constituency is business. Mm-hmm. And if the businesses said, look, this is what we want, those politicians might respond to different incentives and have a different form of leadership.
Your paper focuses on how the business community can play a role in bringing Korea and Japan together. Why businesses?
Politics and economy always influence each other. So we decided to look at the other counterpart, which is businesses.
The empirical evidence that you use in your paper I found to be particularly interesting. In China, we've seen boycotts against Korean products. In certain bilateral issues, we've seen boycotts against Japanese products when there were bilateral issues or territorial disputes. And in these disputes, we've seen commercial interests of both South Korea and Japan be damaged in the Chinese market. And one might also assume, therefore, that similar developments might also take place in Korea-Japan disputes, but you found something quite different. And I was wondering if you could highlight some of the case studies that you looked at.
One of the things that I found pretty consistently, as well as other scholars working on economic coercion used by China or ordinary Chinese citizens in some cases, is that there are certain sectors that consistently get targeted. And these tend to be sectors that have a lot of visibility, either because they're consumer facing, so something like, you know, supermarkets, that sort of thing, or they have high visibility because they're one of these sort of national champion companies, like you brought up. And so the companies that's like, oh, this is a Japanese company, this is a Korean company in some essential way. And those are the ones that tend to get targeted by the state or private citizens. What we tried to do, or what we did do in this paper, was we looked at those specific sectors that were highly visible to see whether or not we could find evidence of economic retaliation or coercion following these political conflicts. And long, short story is that we were unable to find it. So we looked at things like clothing, electronics, media, and we also look at tourism. So looking at the number of Korean tourists that would visit Japan or Japanese tourists that would visit Korea. Again, in crises with China, tourism was greatly affected. But we found just continuity, regular seasonal fluctuation in the Japan-Korea cases going both ways. We also looked at some very high-profile things like pop music, right, where you really might say, well, I don't really like Korea right now, so I'm going to maybe avoid buying K-pop. Mm-hmm. There is a high-profile incident involving BTS. Do you want to talk about BTS?
This BTS issue was triggered by the t-shirt that one of the members was wearing because it has the pictures of Hiroshima and Nagasaki nuclear bomb attacks. So it was very controversial in Japan. So Japanese TV shows canceled the BTS. But later, BTS was still doing really well, ranking number one in Japanese pop song chart. And like their concert tickets were sold out, so we didn't really see like political issues impacting cultural exchange.
Did you get a sense for why this is happening? Why? What makes Korea and Japan ties special, where businesses are insulated from geopolitical tensions, while China-Korea and China-Japan geopolitical issues spill over into the economic space?
There's a few things going on that we highlighted in our research. So one of those things is that there's just different regimes. So South Korea is democratic, and there are different avenues of political participation that South Koreans can take that Chinese cannot. They can lawfully protest. They have more of these civic organizations that can make their grievances heard, either in the Japanese court system, the Korean court system, via their elected representatives, that sort of thing. So there are some other avenues of protest that Koreans can take, and they do. And there are, of course, very high-profile, well-known cases of the sit-ins in front of the Japanese embassy and others. But we found that to be a slightly dissatisfying answer, that it's just regime type, because there are threatened boycotts. They just don't happen. Mm-hmm. Some South Korean activists do say, hey, let's not buy Hello Kitty products, but it just isn't actualized, even though they have the political and economic rights to do so. So what we looked into in our research is we took deep dives into surveys as well as a number of other forms of data, and found that a lot of this is being driven with the way that globalization more generally is integrated into Korean and Chinese society. And we found that in, for example, in regions of China that were more economically integrated, we found more evidence of these forms of economic backlash than we did in Korea. In Korea, we found that for people that lived in the regions of Korea that were more economically integrated with Japan or more globalized in general, we found less. And so there's a more of a sense of positive effects of globalization and a more of a positive engagement with that in Korea and a more negative engagement with that in China. We think that in part is also driving different protest tactics from populations that have very similar historical grievances.
You did mention in the paper that because businesses are insulated from these risks, instead of being a high risk, low reward engagement, it's actually a very low risk and high reward engagement. But at the same time, couldn't you just as easily say that because businesses have nothing to lose, they really don't have any stake in stepping forward?
And that is what, if you go and you talk to Keidanren, the Japanese Business Organization or the Federation of Korean Industries, that's probably what you're going to hear them say. But our counter, we have a counter to that. And we actually think that there's more benefit to businesses if they take a more proactive stance. And in particular, I mean, there's some sort of long-term goals of economic integration between Japan and South Korea that would increase opportunities for profit, that would increase the bottom line for these companies. One of those could be more formal integration into some sort of preferential trading agreement, perhaps even with China. That's been a long-term goal. But then there's also just opportunities that open up new business opportunities if you have less volatility, more predictability, more stability, not having the uncertainty of, will we be able to have this meeting? Right? All of those sort of small interruptions that happen could be smoothed out or disappear. So I think there are real commercial benefits to businesses if they would be take a more proactive stance, right? Become the constituency that tells their politicians, please try and solve these problems rather than exacerbating these problems. Right now, the loud constituencies are all asking for tough resolutions that aren't happening. There is not a constituency that is more vocal and public in saying we would like to see more cooperation.
The conflict between the two countries often revolve around very sensitive issues. Under ideal situations, Professor Casey, where do you see business involvement going to resolve these kind of emotive issues that exist between the two countries?
One of the first steps, I think, is for businesses to just be a little bit more vocal about how they would like to see relations improve. And we did a lot of searching to try and find evidence of that. And we found very limited evidence of any sort of activity like that. I mean, we did find some statements from the Japanese business community following the court case, but I think that they were not very helpful in that they were more dismissive of the claims rather than discussing that there was an issue that needed to be resolved, perhaps for fear of backlash, right, which right, we don't think right. will happen. The first step is that the business community just have a stronger voice in this. Under ideal conditions, something that I think would be very transformative is if particularly the Japanese business community started the very, very hard work of true reconciliation. And there are some models of this working around the world, and actually even with the Japanese business community as it's related to forced labor issues with American prisoners of war. So over the last couple of decades, there are some examples of close personal private work being done with Japanese companies and these former POWs to find peace and reconciliation. And admitting that there's a problem and that the victims are, you know, still victimized and that something needs to be done is a really good first step. And then maybe starting to work with the companies and the former victims together to have discussions, have really hard discussions, perhaps working with civic organizations, NGOs, right, to facilitate that process could be a really great step towards more official reconciliation. But the private sector could play a role there. And again, I don't think that it will affect their bottom line. Mm-hmm. And it would give them deeper moral standing, as well as the ability to move towards deeper ties and more cooperation and more mutual prosperity in the future. So in the medium and long term, I think there's a lot of gains to be made if they would take these maybe difficult first steps.
The first part of this conversation was recorded before the Japanese government announced plans to impose export restrictions on South Korean semiconductor producers. Following the Japanese government's decision, we caught up with Dr. Vakesi by phone to hear her thoughts on the ongoing dispute.
Professor Vakesi, since our last conversation, there's been a lot of developments, and suffice it to say, your presentation was extremely timely. I was wondering if you would provide us with a little bit of commentary on how you see the current spat between Korea and Japan developing.
It's been very frustrating to watch over the last 10 days. A lot of observers are frustrated by how Japan and South Korean relations seem to be going in a very negative direction. The targets of new export restrictions from Japan are extremely narrow and seem to be really targeted to try and force a response from the Korean side. So as many of the listeners probably know, these semiconductor components are very dependent on Japan, somewhere between 70 and 90%. It's difficult to find alternative sources. And if you're looking for some sort of effective economic sanctions kind of policy, this seems to be a really good one because it's difficult to find alternative. And it seems like it will force some sort of response from the South Korean side. Now, what it seems like right now that the response has been a boycott, perhaps, of Japanese products and Japanese economic activity in Korea. So maybe some sort of, you know, negative spiral, maybe even leading to further trade sanctions down the road. The kinds of companies and sectors that get targeted in boycotts are going to be very different from the ones that are targeted from the Japan side. So it won't be semiconductors or any sort of high-tech product like that. We see reports of things like miso and katsuobushi, the fish flakes, being taken off shelves, clothing companies, supermarkets, right? These really high visibility consumer facing companies are where we're seeing it. So business communities on both sides, on the Korean side and the Japanese side, are extremely concerned about this and unhappy. And they didn't see it coming. It was not the policy move that I think they expected Prime Minister Abe of Japan to take. And the organizations have put out statements urging a change in policies. And that's come from both sides. So, for example, the Japanese business organization Keidanren, which represents large businesses, has put out a strong message of concern and that they hope that the policy will change in the future. From the South Korean side, there's been a big meeting of large Korean companies, including like Samsung, Hyundai, LG, companies like that, Lotte, these big conglomerates. They've met with the political leadership in Korea, and then we also saw a vice president of Samsung visit Japan. And we're not exactly sure what happened in that meeting, but we assume that they're, you know, trying to move past these targeted export restrictions. Mm-hmm. So in some ways, I think that this is actually an opportunity for the Japanese and Korean business companies to get more involved.
I see.
Because there are clear economic consequences from these, from the sort of the amping up of the political conflict. And it's a very good entry point for them to say, look, we need to resolve these deeper issues. So our livelihoods, our businesses are not the ones that are put on the line to resolve other problems.
Is this kind of trade dispute between Korea and Japan unprecedented in history?
I am not aware of this sort of trade dispute happening before. Now, maybe some enterprising listener will be able to pull in a case from history that I'm not aware of, but this typically hasn't been the way that issues have been resolved.
Do you feel that the reaction from the Kaidanren and the Korean businesses in response to the recent trade dispute between the two countries, do you feel that is something new?
So I do think that they're being more outspoken than they have been in the past. Mm-hmm. So for example, when the court decision came out last fall, the Japanese business community, including Kaidanren and three other groups, did release a statement saying, you know, let's stick with the agreement of 1965 and don't make this about business anymore. Mm-hmm. We need to move on and have prosperous relations in the future. We're worried that, you know, there'll be consequences from this. So they and that was a fairly mild statement. The more recent statement from Kaidanren, I think, was much more strident than it typically is from the very traditional and reluctant to be politically involved Kaidanren, or at least reluctant to be involved in the international politics. So I do think that that's a new step and maybe points towards a willingness to be a little bit more frontline in the Japan-Korea relationship. My most optimistic take on this is that the big, especially the large businesses, but maybe even the SMEs, the small and medium-sized enterprises from Korea and Japan, could find, you know, start building more sort of coalitions mm-hmm. and rebuild those personal relationships in order to try and resolve some of these problems so they don't start to intrude on their profits too much.
This is a question more about Japan than about South Korea, but do you feel that from what you know about how the Japanese government produces trade policies, was the sanctions policy on the three component parts to semiconductors made with consultation with the Japanese businesses, or was this kind of undertaken without really due consideration of Kaidanren's views and the Japanese private sector?
Right. So typically, when there are sort of industrial trade policies like this, there is consultation with the business sector, and they have these policy councils where there's joint consultation between the government and the bureaucracy and business, where they'll still get a lot of input. Now, it seems from, and this is from, you know, following the news, that the business community was very much taken by surprise by this policy, and it seemed to be something, so it was put out by the Ministry of Economy, Trade, and Industry, and it seemed to be done without the input of the Japanese affected businesses. Currently there is a public comment period and on the policy, so it could be reversed, mm-hmm. and I suspect that the businesses are making their opinion known. I mean, I know they are publicly, and I'm certain they are privately, quite loudly. So we may see a reversal from that in the future. But it did seem to be a very sudden policy without a lot of business consultation in this case. And that is unusual.
Is there anything that you feel American audiences should understand? Or are there items that you feel as though in the current coverage of the trade dispute that is not being covered properly in the United States?
In initial coverage of this, it was being framed as economic sanctions. Mm-hmm. And I used that term as well, like trying to sanction a country. Mm-hmm. But these are not sanctions in the sense of how sanctions are used as a tool of economic diplomacy. Mm-hmm. These are a form of export restrictions that is very legalistic. The symbolism of taking South Korea off an ally list or a white country list, a country that can be implicitly trusted by Japan, is concerning and signals a shift in language. And I think that's something we should really pay attention to. If we want more peaceful and prosperous world of Japan and Korea, the language shift here seems like they're moving further apart. That's very, very concerning. But Japan and Korea, again, they have a lot of potential partnerships and a lot of existing partnerships. And the businesses and the people that are most intimately involved with that and closely involved with that, I think, can do a lot to, you know, maintain that relationship. And now is their opportunity to do so.
That's it for our episode today. Many thanks to Dr. Kristen Vicasey and Jiwon Nam for coming on the show. And to you, listeners, for tuning in. You can find Dr. Vicasey and Ms. Nam's paper in the description of this episode. And keep your eyes open for the upcoming paper by Kristen Vicasey and Jiwon Nam titled Boycotting Japan, Explaining Divergences in Chinese and South Korean Economic Backlash in the December 2019 issue of the Journal of Asian Security and International Affairs. And you can find Dr. Vicasey and other scholars' research on the Korean Peninsula at KEI's website at keia.org. See you there.